We will just have to wonder about the contents of the king's message and where Hamilton's story goes from there. But we do have a related message of our own to offer this morning, one of an acceptance and valuing of each person and each person's perspective as we try to sort out the issues of our modern society. So no matter your personal background or current political beliefs, it is our hope that you feel welcome here this morning and that you might even be comfortable enough to share your own unique perspective. We also have other messages this morning in the form of announcements. These can be found in the order of service. Please give them a look at your convenience. May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to uphold the spirit of freedom. Please rise as you're able and join me in singing our opening hymn, number 159. This is my song. Let us now take a moment to share the joys and sorrows in our lives so that they might be recognized by our mutual community. For shared joy is multiplied and sorrow divided. If you'd like to share, please raise your hand and the mic will be brought to you.
Good morning, Susan Adamchak. I have a joy and a sorrow. The joy is I spoke this morning with Harriet. She wanted everyone to know she's doing fine. She had her surgery about 2 weeks ago. Some of you have started to see her out and about, but she's still very weak and tired, and so she's saving her energy today for a visit with Rhonda later on. My sorrow is just a reflection on the events yesterday, both in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and also in Baghdad, with so many more people killed. Increasingly, many of you know that I traveled quite a bit for work, and I always felt pretty safe because I was going to these pretty remote places, but I've been in several of the places that have been in the news lately, and it's just harder and harder to just accept this as part of the daily news. So I hope you all would just keep the victims and their families in your minds.
Larry Weaver, I have a joy that my 22-year-old granddaughter called me up yesterday and said, Opa Larry, I'm coming to Manhattan. And so I'm going to have a house guest starting tomorrow evening, and I'm absolutely delighted.
Hi, I'm Kristen Corwin. Many of you will remember, this is a joy, by the way. Many of you will remember Jessica Martin Long, who, mother of Katie and Colton, who went through a very difficult divorce several years ago. Well, yesterday she got remarried to a wonderful man named Jordan Linsford, and he's pledged to be there for the kids forever, and it was just wonderful. So I'm very, very happy.
No one else?
Okay.
Well, thank you to everyone who did share. So if the children would like to join us up front, it's time for the story for all ages. Today's story is Vote for Me by Ben Clanton. Yep, that's the one. How do we want to do this?
Hey, you. Yes, you. With the great hair and that dazzling smile. Listen, you should...
Don't listen to the donkey. You're too smart for that. You'll want to...
Vote for me! Why should you vote for me?
Why indeed?
Because I'm number one.
Number one big head.
Well, what's so great about you?
I'm a super cute elephant. How can you not vote for someone as adorable as me?
Not to change the subject, but I've got a question I've been meaning to ask you. Do you like candy? Because if you vote for me, I'll give you a sucker.
You are a sucker if you vote for him. Besides, if you vote for me, I'll give you peanuts.
Nuts? My Uncle Sam is allergic to nuts. Speaking of family... As it turns out, I know your friends, mothers, aunts, gym teachers, pastors, duck-billed platypus. So, we're practically family. And you've got to vote for family.
If a word of that made sense, then I'm a monkey's uncle.
Forget the elephant in the room. He's just jealous of the redunculously awesome list of reasons why you should pick me.
What? One of the things on this list says that elephants stink. Elephants don't stink.
Well, you certainly do, you big, stinky pooper scooper.
Pooper scooper, eh? Well, take this, you nincompoop. Mudslinging happens.
Yes, yes, mudslinging. Booger breath.
Uh-oh, there's one hitting me now.
Dim-witted oaf.
Belching beast of burden.
Smelly pants.
Snot sucker.
I know you are, but what am I?
That's my line.
Oh.
I know you are, but what am I?
Jumbo.
Donkey.
Did you really mean all those mean things you said?
No. Did you?
No. I'm sorry. Friends?
Friends.
Well, even though Elephant and I are friends now, you still need to pick just one of us.
So, who do you want to vote for? Go ahead and shout it out.
And now let's find out who won.
Drum roll, please.
I can't believe it.
The winner is...
The Independent Mouse.
I would like to thank the millions of mice who voted for me to become the big cheese.
I want a recount. I was obviously the best choice.
Actually, I was the best choice. Infinity.
Nuh-uh, infinity and one.
Well, yaha, one more than whatever you say next, and there's nothing more, and that is the end.
Shine your heart.
That was fun. So now I would like to do an activity with the adults. In researching today's topic, I found a quote by Thomas Jefferson that rings perhaps even more truly today as when it was penned in 1805. "Convinced that the people are the only safe depositories of their own liberty, and that they are not safe unless enlightened to a certain degree, I have looked upon our present state of liberty as a short-lived possession unless the mass of the people could be informed to a certain degree." And that quote made me think. The one bit that I think has changed remarkably is that certain degree to which we need to be informed. The world is a more complicated place after 200 plus years of development. I think this is worth illustrating with a quick demonstration. Let's make a list of some issues that we should at least be aware of in order to make good decisions about how we're going to run our nation. So again, please raise your hand to have the mic brought to you if you'd like to present an issue. Or just mention it. You don't have to go into detail. Yeah, that might derail us quite quickly. I'd start us off by saying that I am concerned with addressing poverty.
Protecting the environment.
Yeah, environmental issues.
So many.
There are.
Immigration.
Definitely a wedge issue this season. I may have spelled it right.
LGBT issues.
Mm-hmm.
In the same vein, civil rights in general.
Yeah, civil rights.
The use of weapons in murder.
Yeah, weapons. I'm going to write gun control.
Reducing violence and harm reduction.
What was that one?
Reducing violence, harm reduction.
Oh, harm reduction, okay.
War in the Middle East.
Sorry, my ears aren't working this morning.
War in the Middle East.
Oh, yes.
War is plural.
Get me a workout. Organize your thoughts from one side to the other.
It's the economy, silly.
Yeah, the economy.
Population.
I've just become aware that because my daughter's a kindergarten teacher, that they're focusing in schools on, I can't remember the term exactly, but trauma something schools. So many children are exposed to trauma. So children and trauma.
Affordability of education.
Yeah.
Okay. Women's reproductive rights.
Affordable health care.
Definitely health care.
Freedom of speech and civil liberties in general. Freedom of the press.
The
lack of mental health care?
We can do a couple more. The board's getting full.
Racial inequality.
Income inequality.
One more.
Can I give two?
Sure.
Regressive taxation and privatized prisons.
Well, great. We made quite the list very quickly. Pardon, I have two mics and it's confusing me. I can handle it in a second, thank you. So the point of this was I'd like to ask you all to consider a few questions as we lead into the offertory. Can a person be expected to have a proper understanding of each of these topics when they're only limited to their own point of view and their own experiences? Can a single person even be expected to encounter each of these problems? So how then can we expect a person to weigh these sometimes competing issues and decide upon a best course of action without help from their neighbors? Perhaps more than ever, we need to be able to engage in civil discourse if we're going to be the informed and enlightened depositories of our liberty that we all need to be. Thank you both. So we went over the importance of civil discourse, and it seems like communicating ideas should be an easy task, but I think we all know differently from experience. So now I'd like to share some common pitfalls that prevent an effective exchange and how to hopefully avoid them. Firstly, it's important to recognize our own motivations when we voice disagreement with someone. There are good reasons to criticize the beliefs of others. Beliefs do inform actions, and other people's actions do have a potential impact upon us. But even this view assumes that we have the correct view, and that it's others that need to do the correcting. This is often a problem, given that everyone naturally thinks that their view is correct, otherwise they wouldn't hold it. I seem to be drawing on the wisdom of the 1800s today, so I'll present the solution to this problem from the 1866 Martin's Handbook of Etiquette and Guide to True Politeness. Let your aim be to come at truth, not to conquer your opponent, so you never shall be at a loss in losing the argument and gaining a new discovery. And I have to admit, even while reading this high-minded advice, a part of me is just screaming, but how's the other person going to know they're wrong? That's the part of me that's made every one of the mistakes I'm here today cautioning against and more. We have to give the people we're talking with some credit. They might not admit to being swayed, especially right away or in a public setting. But if we're able to have honest conversations and our views are able to withstand them, the effect will show over time. It's important to understand that changing a mind is a long-term project, especially when we're addressing a strongly held or deep-seated belief. It's a matter of presenting a good case and really just allowing time for the mind to change itself. If we attempt to force our conclusions on another person, we can become seen as adversarial. This actually has the undesired response of pushing others further into their own corner. In response to this, we can easily become adversarial and push ourselves further into ours, maybe without even realizing it. It's an unfortunate quirk of our psychology that causes this polarization and keeps us from hearing each other, but it can be largely avoided by being aware of it and essentially just treating each other with respect. And if we do treat each other with respect in this way, we will not only be refining our own views through counterargument, but establishing a reputation for ourselves that can only aid in future discussions. In addition to the person we're speaking to, it's also worth considering the wider audience of our message. I doubt anyone here has plans to engage in any formal debates soon, but we can still expect that people other than the one we're speaking to will, if not hear our words directly, definitely hear about them. We don't want the person we're talking to be able to say that they've never had an encounter with a reasonable dissenting view. We want them to investigate our reasonable dissenting view, which, again, if we've been fair, we can trust them to do in their own time. They may even seek help from others who believe the same way they do, so who knows how many people our message can reach in this way. And if we are speaking in a more public forum, I think today's children's story demonstrated how a lack of respect is immediately noticed. In addition to trusting the person you're talking to, you can also trust an audience to raise an eyebrow at that kind of thing. So, now to the practical application of all this. Contemporary philosopher Daniel Dennett's four steps for composing a successful critical commentary. Number one, you should attempt to re-express your target's position so clearly, vividly, and fairly that your target says, "Thanks, I wish I'd thought of putting it that way." This is the principle of charity in a nutshell. Try to consider the best, strongest interpretation of the opposing argument. It's easy to respond to our preconception of another person's position or a weaker version of it than they've presented, but neither of those are going to be convincing to that person. Quite the opposite. We're likely to be perceived as obtuse, stubborn, or even dishonest and simply not worth talking to. We need to listen to what is actually being said and respond charitably. Number two, you should list any points of agreement, especially if they are not matters of widespread or general agreement. It's actually very rare that someone's position is completely polarly opposite ours. So we should build bridges to shared understanding where we can. Opposite this is the impulse to prove the opposition completely wrong, which in our zeal can cause us to overreach what we can actually support. Instead of worrying about winning an argument at any cost, a surefire way to alienate people, we want to focus on winning hearts and minds. Number three, you should mention anything you have learned from your target. This follows from the last point, in that it's okay, even vital, to recognize the accurate parts of the opposing view. None of us know everything, and we sometimes depend upon others to show us new information or point out what we've missed or gotten wrong. Showing that we're able to refine our views based on new information is a huge step in establishing a rapport with another person. And finally, number four, only after following steps 1 through 3 are you permitted to say so much as a word of criticism. By following these steps, we strive to find any value in the other side. We don't simply dismiss it as refuse, and we avoid becoming the object of the scorn that Mark Twain so elegantly expressed when he wrote, "The critic's symbol should be the tumble bug. He deposits his egg in somebody else's dung. Otherwise, he could not hatch it." Because, again, the opposition's view is not to be viewed as dung, and we're certainly not in the business of rooting around in such. No, the opposing view is a conclusion come to, for presumably some reason, by a thinking person. We have to ask ourselves, is the person we're talking to a complete idiot? And as easy as it is to dismiss their argument by thinking yes, the answer is no. So the question becomes, why do two people inhabiting the same world believe different things? And if we follow this system, I know we're capable of building a foundation upon which it can be answered. So in that spirit, please rise again as you're willing and able for our second hymn, number 1023 in the Teal Hymnal, Building Bridges.
Thank you.
Nice. That is really such a lovely demonstration of harmony, a good round. I am never quite sure what to do with patriotic holidays.
I'm wearing the red, white, and blue, though. Yeah.
There are many options. I could just ignore the whole thing, but the truth is I really like an occasional Sousa march. It lifts my spirits whether I want them lifted or not. I could jump in with both feet into the whole red, white, and blue extravaganza, shooting fireworks and belting out patriotic ballads and from time to time wincing a little when something strikes me as simply too jingoistic. Or maybe ignore the patriotic pieces and make it time for a party. And that doesn't seem quite right either. I cannot help but think about the values of America at these times. And every time I do that, I think of the ways we fall short of the ideals that we've laid out, as well as the ways we've succeeded. And my tendency towards self-examination cannot resist expanding to examination of community and of country, of everything of which I am part. So here we are, poised to celebrate the 4th of July with elevated terror alert warnings. A little more frightened, still recovering from Orlando and then Istanbul and Bangladesh. Wondering if the freedoms that were declared in the declaration that we celebrate are under more threat from without or from within as we protect ourselves from outside threats. What a time for democracy, eh? The splintered media paints a picture of two well-defined, sharply divided sides duking it out for power, influence, and the recasting of America or the world in the ideals or slogans that they champion with no regard for anyone else's opinion. Even the media takes sides, one or the other, Fox TV, the Drudge Report versus MSNBC and Huffington Post. Divisiveness is firmly rooted in the political realm. Nonprofit and advocacy organizations routinely leap on any news story they find to push their cause for more funding. More than once, I have replied to appeals by organizations whose work I generally like, saying, "I do not respond to opportunistic fear-mongering." Unfortunately, I think a lot of people do. So my efforts merely tilt at windmills. On top of that, we're in the midst of an election cycle where it's a selling point to have no actual experience in government, to be as far away as possible from the establishment, which presumably is what the candidates themselves are hoping to become. Even the buying of elections, widely practiced by the Koch brothers and other corporate behemoths, has been eclipsed by the uprising of the dissatisfied antis. A side note, the UUA at our General Assembly last week selected a congregational study action issue titled Corruption of the Democracy. Corruption of our democracy. The issue is, as corporations use corporate personhood and money as speech for their interests rather than the people's needs, can a constitutional amendment be passed to protect us? Could this further Unitarian Universalist work for social and environmental justice and help protect the health and safety of the people and the planet? That's just an aside, but our association is attending to the state of democracy in at least one of its aspects. And at the same time, more and more electioneering has become name-calling, derision, and the kind of nastiness we heard in the children's story, the story for all ages, that you watch a debate and you feel like you need a shower afterward. And all of this is amplified by the World Wide Web. You can find and join the fights personally, day and night,
posting and reposting even articles proven to be riddled with lies at a pace and tenor that would alienate even the most determined supporter of small d democracy. There is no responsibility or accountability in the online arena, says African-American activist and founder of the Dream Defenders, Uma Selah. He goes on, there is an anonymity that shields many from the repercussions of lies, faux leadership, or hateful rhetoric, allowing for many to enjoy the fruits of freedom without the labor of accountability. On the other hand, he reminds us, a true democracy weighs both the power of individual identity with the responsibility to the collective. Maybe there can be some brief hiatus this weekend to celebrate true democracy with some kind of illusion of togetherness under the red and blue, along with the white. But that'll fade away promptly if it lasts the 3-day weekend. I fear nothing will help this year. Now, this sermon could easily turn into a rant against the political class and their allies in the corporate and media worlds in this election year, with special jabs reserved for those most able to sidetrack sanity and exploit bigotry and nativism. But I don't see that as a particularly useful exercise. Cathartic, maybe, but not helpful. Catherine Lofton, chair of the Yale Department of Religious Studies, offers this perspective. She writes, "So where is the respectability and where is the civil society in this election? I think that is not just a social question, it is also a foundationally religious question about how we think our leaders ought to represent some idea of social community." A foundationally religious question. What does she mean by that? We have separation of church and state, right? How is the civil society a religious question? I can't read Lofton's mind, but I can offer my perspective on how this question of respectability and civil society is religious. As we speak about forming a social community, a grouping where we can work together toward a better future, establish laws and policies and practices that enhance life for our citizens, that is, as we form government, we are drawing on questions that are fundamentally religious. What are the values that inform our decisions? To whom and what do we offer loyalty? What ideals shape our vision of the future? Even who has the privilege to speak? Who deserves to be heard? These questions reside underneath the questions of who do we vote for, or even what policies do we pursue. These are foundationally religious questions about how we think our leaders ought to represent some idea of social community. What do we value? What do we worship? These questions have continually been fought over in this country. The esteem poured on the hit Broadway musical Hamilton that we heard a snippet from as this morning's prelude comes not only because of the creative genius of Lin-Manuel Miranda, but also from the issues examined. The fight to establish what our national norms and expectations are. Too often, history is taught in a way that leads us to believe that the results of battles and even arguments were inevitable, and that once they were won or lost, everything was decided. It was set in stone. Miranda reminds us through Hamilton. He brings alive those old arguments. He reminds us the way in revolutionary times was far from clear. The loyalists, like Farmer in the recording, fought the revolutionaries. Jefferson fought Hamilton. Adams fought Jefferson, and Burr and Hamilton. Well, their struggles comprise the meat of the show, Hamilton. And even if you don't know the musical, you're probably not surprised that the show ends with Burr, the vice president of the U.S., shooting Hamilton in a duel. Now, you may be surprised to learn that there are three, count them, three duels in the musical Hamilton. At least we've gotten rid of duels in the political context. I think I'm happy about that. Too often, we believe that political doctrine, the way we do things, has been settled once and for all, one way or another, or the other. We were founded as a Christian nation, yells one side. The founders clearly stated in the First Amendment that no religion was to be established. And the problem is, just like proof texting from the Bible, you can find substantiations on both sides. Because the fact is, the founders didn't agree with each other. Some of them evolved on the issues. And they argued even then about the extent to which different religions could live peaceably side by side. They argued about whether individual states could provide tax money to churches. And they argued about whether or not we had a Christian nation. People like to argue, and that's not going away. Let me rephrase that. People have different viewpoints based in different experiences and values. And they like to feel secure in their rightness, that their basic viewpoints, experiences, and values reflect reality more accurately than other people's might. And when those others challenge them, they may not feel secure. And I believe that part of what we are experiencing at this point in American history, maybe in world history, I know America best, is a pervasive sense of insecurity reflected in clinging tenaciously to our own particular views of reality. And as voices grow in volume and vehemence, we find ourselves talking across one another until inevitably the discourse oversimplifies and we get essentially to am not are too. My dear friend Bob Waldrop, a radical Catholic musician and activist, says, "We have the government we have because we are the people we are. If we want a better government, we must become a better people, and that means that each of us, without exceptions, should strive to become a better person." So this is the obvious place in my reflection this morning to make the expected call for civility. We all know what civility is: being respectful, offering the benefit of the doubt, not speaking ill of others, taking responsibility for our own shortcomings, blah, blah, blah. Seriously, though, it's hard in the best of circumstances with people we love, people in our families, people in our congregation. It can be hard to be respectful and civil all the time. We scrape at each other with our personality differences, our preferences, our stress levels. U.S. Minister Nancy McDonald Ladd, in her sermon last week at General Assembly, called this kind of relationship and exploration of difference the sandpaper of the holy that helps to wear down our resistance to change, and I also suggest it wears away some of the rough edges that we all have that keep us from being our best person. We end up actually better together with confronting difference because other people make us be better. And what about when we're not in the best of circumstances with those we love or at least feel motivated to maintain relationship with, but in the worst of circumstances? When we're talking about those people who are really, truly, radically different from us, those who we don't think we can ever understand and who don't get us at all, who we are convinced don't only have a different view of the world, but are outright deliberately lying to misrepresent reality. The ones we would have a duel with if we still did that sort of thing. If we have trouble being nice to the people we like, how on earth do we even consider civility with these others? Much less love and compassion, which our most deeply religious and spiritual callings might demand of us. Lately, I've heard talk about a problem with the UU slogan, standing on the side of love. We all love that slogan, right? Standing on the side of love. Some UUs have suggested that the claim that love has one side can lead to divisiveness. Jesus invited people to love not those who love them, but to love their enemies. Maybe love extends beyond and outside of sides. We often miss the intent of the parable of the Good Samaritan. We forget that the Samaritans were hated and despised, that they were the equivalent of Muslim Syrian immigrants or maybe even ISIS operatives. They were the enemy, and yet they were the answer to the question, who is my neighbor? Maybe love extends beyond and outside of sides. Or maybe that's just too far to go today. What about simply treating those with whom we disagree with respect? Even when they're misbehaving and being disrespectful, sneaky and disingenuous, when they call their opponents, us, names, and use unethical tactics, and maybe even pull out guns and blow up buildings. Can we still be civil? Krista Tippett, the radio host of On Being and WARE lecturer at General Assembly, offered a helpful suggestion. She says she doesn't use the word civility anymore without adding an adjective, like muscular or adventurous. The reminder that civility does not have to mean wimpiness. It's not the same thing as Kansas nice. So what might muscular civility look like? It might look like Ruby Bridges, the 6-year-old, surrounded by marshals who entered all-white William Franz Elementary School in 1960. You've seen the pictures of her walking past crowds of distorted, ugly faces with a certain grace and courage, and without an ounce of disrespect. She's still an activist today. Muscular civility might look like Dorothea Dix in the 19th century, publishing articles about the prevalence of mental illness in jails and prisons, work relevant again today, speaking honestly and clearly to those who might rather not have heard what she had to say. Muscular civility might look like Nelson Mandela negotiating with de Klerk to end apartheid and hold elections by all the people in the 1990s in South Africa. And it might sound like the stories told to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, working for a shift in the culture's psyche. Muscular civility might look like BGLTQ people telling the truths of their lives, supporting one another through the shootings in Orlando. Muscular civility might even look like Black Lives Matter activists closing highways. Direct action does not have to be disrespectful, even if it is inconveniencing. It is inconvenient to hear the truth at times, no matter how it's delivered. Direct action may be the most civil thing that can happen if it's grounded in honesty and respect. Muscular civility includes a determination to speak truth and live truth, to stand up and be counted, to defy if defiance is needed, without spitting in anyone's face, even when they're spitting in yours. That's hard stuff. That requires a spiritual depth. And then adventurous civility, she suggested. Adventurous civility may look like Frances Kissling. Krista Tippett also introduced me to her through her radio program. Kissling used to chair Catholics for Choice. Now, you can imagine that might be a difficult place in which to sit. I'm guessing that Kissling was in a lot of rooms on both sides where people did not get her. Catholics, wary of her pro-choice stance, pro-choice activists shaking their heads about her Catholicism. I can imagine some of the questions and accusations. I bet she heard from both sides, "Why do you stay in the church?" She retired from Catholics for Choice in 2007, and since then, she's been deliberately talking with and listening to people on the other side of the abortion issue. She's gone into the conversations without intending to come to any common ground or change anyone's mind, simply to try to understand, to get past the polarized sides of the issue and engage with it at its depth. That is brave. Just as brave as the direct action I labeled as muscular civility. Listening, says Dave, I say of StoryCorps, is an act of love. To listen to others requires that we give them the benefit of the doubt, that we respect them. The only way to get past the frozen stereotypes of the other side that media has sold us is to talk and listen respectfully. And if the idea of listening to those people makes you a little nauseous, I confess it does me, then consider, what is our alternative? To try to beat them at any cost? To demonize them? To relegate them to people whose thoughts don't matter? Those ideas are even more repugnant to me. And more moderately, Tippett suggests we ask the question, are we not of interest to one another? Of course, if we listen to someone else, if we understand their perspective, we might end up changing our mind. We, our identity, are not our opinions. Maybe something would shift. So we have to be vulnerable. We have to get past those vast oversimplifications that have replaced thoughtful argument. We have to understand that we share a common life even if we do not share common ground. We have to shift from competing certainties to curiosity. We have to let go of the idea that we will come to an agreement and simply try to understand one another better. We have to ask people about their stories and about their values rather than the polarizing questions about their candidate or their policy preferences. We have to listen to what has hurt them and what keeps them awake at night and share the same about ourselves. There are people we may not be able to engage this way, who will not tolerate it, who only want to yell and scream. And the best advice for dealing with them is to walk away. They are energized by the fight. Let it go. Maybe someday they will become people who can be engaged. Do you know the story of Megan Phelps Roper? You may recognize the name Phelps, the Phelps family, the core of the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, infamous for picketing funerals, churches, and anyone who doesn't believe in a God as hateful as they are. These are the least likely people in the world to engage in thoughtful sharing of nuanced ideas. Megan Phelps Roper used to be the Twitter voice of Westboro Baptist Church, tweeting out what you would expect. AIDS is God's curse on you, that sort of thing. And people responded, as they will, on Twitter. Somehow she got engaged in a back and forth with David Arbible, who had a Jewish culture blog called Jewlicious. Arbible said he didn't want to debate Westboro, he just wanted to make fun of them. And the two unlikely correspondents began to appreciate one another's sense of humor. She also began to appreciate, Megan also began to appreciate the feelings of other people that she saw expressed on Twitter. She began to see their humanity. And then she started tweeting with another Twitter user, CG, someone who was initially nasty, but then started asking questions with real curiosity about her life inside Westboro. They began playing words with friends. Other stuff went on in her life, political infighting inside the church, doctrinal questions, and eventually she left Westboro. And she credits much of her change to her Twitter interactions. And after she left the church, she started dating CG. This kind of engagement requires what I can only label as spiritual work, listening deeply underneath the differences, suspending our convictions and wondering, what if? Holding the yin along with the yang. There are theorists, psychoanalyst Carl Jung among them, who say that if we hold the tensions of opposing forces, a third way will emerge. However, you have to fully hold the tensions, acknowledge all the ways the views are contradictory. The third way doesn't come if you try to force it. It has to emerge and transcend the distinctions. It may take years for that to happen. I have a little closing here, but before I do that, I'm going to ask if there are thoughts, questions, comments. We have a few minutes. Not debate. I'm not asking for any debate.
Linda Johnson, a few years ago, or sometime in the last 10 years or so, I decided that I would take up what she refers to as muscular civility and no longer just listen politely while people said things that I thought were ridiculous or wrong or just plain stupid. So in that time period, we also have taken a number of cruises and world tours and that sort of thing. You run into lots of people on cruise ships who are, I guess, pretty well off and pretty right-wing. So I have shocked many people by saying things like, no, it's not true that everybody thinks labor unions have outlived their usefulness. And no, it's not true that all people on welfare are lazy parasites and so forth. And I hope I've lived up to the rules that were listed earlier about being at least decent in not saying you're stupid, but but I have decided that you really don't want to let people get away with saying that sort of thing and not challenging them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the key is challenging the ideas. I mean, we don't want to challenge somebody's humanity, but we can challenge their ideas. Yeah.
Well, they say hard cases make bad law, so maybe I'm off base here in taking up a hard case. But consider abortion, a position that I expect most of us in this room are think this is pretty much a matter between a woman and her doctor. But there are decent people who think it is murder of an innocent. Mm-hmm. And so we're not going to likely change that belief on their side or mine. But we are required, we're forced by our society to step into support or not support laws about this. And So it seems to me that we, that I may, and they may have to accept a compromise in which we vote for policies that we, in some degree, completely disagree with. Such as, for example, maybe enshrine in law the 1973 situation. The first trimester, it's my position. The last trimester, it's their position. And this is very hard on both sides. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, all of these things are really hard. I mean, there's a lot of issues that are just that divisive. But there are a lot of issues that shouldn't be that divisive, that don't need to be that divisive, but that we make that divisive just because we're yelling at each other already. So, you know, I think about when you started talking, I thought about the time that I was at the Capitol in Oklahoma, and we were lobbying. We were lobbying on immigration. And so I was lobbying with a number of people who were Catholic. And one of them invited me to come back to the Capitol for when they hand out their red roses, you know, when they do their pro-life thing. And I said, not interested. But we could work together on immigration. And just because we don't agree on abortion doesn't mean we can't work together on immigration. But then we have relationship. Then we have relationship, and maybe we can go somewhere from that. I don't know. I mean, one of the things that one of the mysterious ways that the world works is that sometimes stuff comes out that you don't know what's going to happen. You try to do your best. You try to treat people decently and recognize there are things that we're not going to agree on.
Hi, Anna Franklin. So first, Jonalu, this is a great program, and all of you, I'm glad we're having this. And I think that you spoke to this when you were giving your talk, but I think it's an important point, and maybe a little subtle, maybe something. Our thoughts and ideas are all woven in with our identity and our emotions in our life experience, mm-hmm. and so to change those is like dying in a way. So it's like it's not just a battle between ideas, it's almost like a mortal thing. We think something, we feel it, we make it part of ourselves, and then it's like defending our lives. And so we have to come to a point where we understand that just because we have this idea, it's not, you know, we're not going to die, disappear, or become something other just because we're willing to listen and maybe even to give that idea up, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the main sticking point, is like, it's me. You're threatening me. Like when I gave up meat way back in the 70s, a lot of people felt very threatened when we went to a restaurant and I only ordered vegetarian. Well, what's wrong? What's wrong? You know, I eat meat. So, you know, they began to feel like I was somehow insulting them, threatening them, saying that they were wrong. And that's the last thing anyone wants to think, is that they're wrong. Mm-hmm. It's okay. You're wrong most of the time, actually.
Well, and that's where we have to hold that distinction between myself and my point of view. And sometimes, I mean, really, an attack on a point of view is not an attack on a person.
Yes.
An attack on a point of view is not an attack on a person. That's something that we have to really get into our minds. That, you know, if somebody attacks what I think, That's not a personal attack. If somebody tells me I'm stupid, that is a personal attack. And we don't want to do personal attacks, but we can certainly challenge ideas. Yeah. And challenge our own ideas. I mean, that's part of what I often try to do, is challenge my own ideas.
So this is a little bit of a different topic, but I realize how lucky my family is in that after my parents divorced, there was a time, not all the time, but there was a time when the exes and the children and extended family members from both sides could sit down at the high school gymnasium having the dinner before my sister's theater production, and at a distance, you would not know what the current relationship status was. And I give them a lot of credit for being able to set down their differences so that we can enjoy each other's company and not make us choose which side to be on. So in the last year, it's been very apparent to me that I could become, maybe not this person's, but eventually somebody's stepmother. And it's been very challenging for me to think of the opposition, the other, you know, the mother of the children. And Kelly Richardson McBee, bless her heart, had a heart-to-heart with me for a little while at Buren Theology. Another reason you should come. And she said, go to her as, I'm on your side, and I want to do what's best for the kids, and I'm just an added hand to help or to give that much more love. So I really appreciate looking at problems differently. You know, I have to recognize that at one point, those two people loved each other enough to have not one but two children together. And it's not a battle. It's not fighting over the kids. It's fighting for the kids. So that's other conflicts that you can think about in a lot of situations.
In most situations, there are not two sides, actually. In most situations, there's a multiplicity of sides, of facets. It's an oversimplification, usually, when we break it down to two sides.
Christopher Renner, how do we deal with the anti-intellectualism, though? That's one of the issues. I have this great cousin out in California. He's been a paraplegic since he's 12 years old. He still thinks that Nixon was a great president, if that gives you any indication. And we have these ongoing discussions sometimes on Facebook. And, you know, he'll say, well, that's not true. And I'll quote Scopes saying, no, it is true. For example, California just had a new law passed that now makes voter registration automatic when you get your driver's license. Since non-documented people in California can get driver's license, of course, he was saying that non-documented people are going to start voting in California. And I said, no, that's not true. That's not true. That he says, yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And he won't even bother to read the actual law. He hears a soundbite, and he repeats it. I find that the hardest thing in this ongoing discussion.
That is hard. I have conversations with my mother where I just give up. Because part of what's happened is that media has constructed alternative realities. there's these complete alternative realities that's not even real. You know, I mean the whole birther thing. You know, it just doesn't even. It's just not real. And, you know, sometimes I think we just have to let it go and walk away from some of those. Because what else can you do?
I was just going to mention a vignette that I saw this week of the media jumping on a completely unreal story. I'll admit my dad watches Fox TV, and so when I go over, I'm exposed to it. So on Thursday morning, when I brought him back to his apartment, Fox was breathlessly covering an event that was taking place at Andrews Air Force Base when it was mistakenly, there was a scheduled drill in case there was a shooter on the base. And the drill was taking place, and one person who wasn't aware that there was going to be this drill tweeted something about, "We're under attack." Well, Fox News was all over it, to the point where they had commentators already speculating or stating, not even speculating, that this was an ISIS-driven event and that they had managed to breach the security. And it was just complete fiction. And, you know, and it was just, it was frightening how strongly they were reporting this non-story as truth and how quickly they brought in all of these experts who knew nothing about what was going on to say a government installation is under attack. And I went home and I asked my husband, I said, "Did you hear this?" And he said, "No." And I started Googling on, you know, NPR and the other news outlets, and no one was reporting this at all. And Fox spent more than 2 hours on this story, or this non-story. Anyway, it was just, it was, when we're exposed to that kind of information in an election cycle, when we're supposed to be making informed decisions, it's very worrisome.
One of the things that has really been brought home to me is the importance of checking and rechecking sources. I mean, checking and rechecking sources, because, you know, there used to be a requirement in the news world that before they reported something, they had to have actual confirmations of it. And that's kind of what I do now, is look for confirmations. I mean, I don't trust anything unless I've found at least a couple of reliable sources that are saying, yes, that's true. You know, we have to be, and part of what you mentioned is the anxiety levels. I think we have to do as much as we can to lower those anxiety levels, because we've got this knee-jerk, we've got to move forward, we've got to do this right now, you know, and the internet and that stuff encourages that so much. So, a lot of breathing. I think we have a very appropriate closing song for that. It's "Voice Still and Small," number 391. Closing words from Maureen Killoran. "In the challenge of our days, I am one who supports my country, right or wrong, and I am one who claims the traditions of dissent, and I am an American. In this polarized season, I am Democrat, and I am Republican, I am Libertarian, and I am Independent, I am Green, and I am Confused, and I am an American. Spirit of hope, sit with us in our diversities. Help us hear one another in our divisions. Grant that beginning in this community, we may honor one another's truths and know that a just and faithful tomorrow begins here in our hearts. For with all our problems, with all our pains, with all our limitations and mistakes, we are Americans. Happy 4th of July."